welcome to the Stanza Poetry Podcast. It's been a busy day this Saturday with some excellent events, and this podcast is crammed full of them. From new and emerging voices to old and established ones, we hope there's something for everyone. But we start proceedings off with an excerpt from today's Poetry Breakfast, which was on the theme of myth and legend in poetry. Tiffany Atkinson starts the ball rolling, and then we'll hear from Monizah Alvey, then Stephen Halliwell, and finally, Rebecca Seiferle.
I was thinking, just in preparation for this, about how myth and legends sort of work into my own poetry. And actually, they only do so fairly recently, or at least in an explicit way. But I am very interested in what other poets do and how, and the sort of sources that they're drawn to. And I suppose how contemporary poets in particular tend to use myths and legends as a kind of common currency, and I suppose what we'd have to say is generally a secular age, and that sort of idea that most of us are familiar with many of the narratives. I mean, Caroline Duffy, I suppose, is the most sort of glaring example. That they're kind of they're porous stories, aren't they? And they give quite a lot of elasticity, I suppose, for poets to sort of use them in different ways, or writers of all sorts to use them in different ways. Particularly ways of kind of metabolizing personal experience as well, which is how I suppose I've used them most so far. But I don't necessarily think that's the most interesting way of using them. Mm-hmm. That's just about as far as I've got in my kind of grade one kind of use of existing literatures. But I mean, my second collection, the Catullus, I mean, actually what I'm more interested in there is the, not so much the content of classical literatures and fables and myths, but actually the form, the way of telling, the particular qualities of that kind of literature, sort of lamenting or sort of patterning, and the almost not ahistorical, but there's a sort of a sense of fictive time, I suppose, that is given by fables and so forth, which I quite enjoy using in a contemporary setting, if that makes any sense.
Well, it's only recently with Europa that I've used a given myth at great length. But I think probably a myth has come up in various forms throughout the poems in different ways. Sometimes I feel that the use of myth in poetry can be referred to a bit disparagingly as the myth kitty. But I feel it's a... This is a rich and vital source, and many of our most powerful poets have drawn on myth superbly. And women writers, I think, can be especially drawn to the otherness of myth, the way that a myth can is powerful and can release your pent-up energies, and as we've said, often subverting the myth. With Mrs. Midas, for example, and Achilles linked to David Beckham, most recently, yeah. Which I thought was rather well done. Yeah, they can have many interpretations. Because if you take a story like Red Riding Hood, and you think, well, how can that be done again and again in poetry? But it is, and everyone makes their own thing of it.
So I'm particularly interested, as someone who studies ancient Greece, in the relationship between myth and poetry, particularly in early Greece, where actually it's very hard to tell them apart. Mm-hmm. They're so closely intertwined in the archaic and classical periods of Greece that really you can't talk about one without talking about the other. So if you want to talk about almost any of the major branches of Greek poetry, that's epic, drama, and lyric, myth will confront you everywhere. Equally, if you want to argue, as a lot of scholars do, about the nature of Greek myth, where it comes from, what it means, what its cultural roots are, and so forth, you have to go to poetry, essentially, to find it. Poetry that gives us our only real access to early Greek myth. Mm-hmm. And you just can't talk about either of these things without the other. And I think that's because they are both, for Greeks, ways of, as it were, saturating stories, narratives, language, with the deepest meaning they can find. And it's also interesting, you know, that in very early Greek, so in Homeric Greek, for example, although the word mouthos is there in related words, it doesn't mean what we would now mean by myth. In its earliest use, it seems to mean speech and utterance, that kind of thing. But for a long time after that, actually, Greeks don't really have a concept of myth. That's to say, they don't have a separate category of myth. Mm. Instead, though, they have this kind of cultural air they breathe, which, from a later point of view, is this mixture of song, stroke, poetry, and mythology. So those are the labels we put on these things, but really it's a kind of air they breathe and a repertoire of stories through which they think. And if I could just add very quickly before going back to the others, it's very interesting from my point of view that I think every one of the points that's already been made by the contemporary poets here about the way they use myth and think of myth is actually already true in early Greece. So it's not, as it were, that Greek poets use myth in a certain way and modern poets are now doing something different. Mm-hmm. This notion of myths constantly being changed, transformed in the telling, the otherness of them, which was a term used, that's a very Greek attitude to myth. The subversiveness of doing different things with myth. I mean, apart from anything else, you know, Greeks have a wonderful tradition of comic mythology where they take their own most serious myths and play with them. So, you know, Aristophanic comedy is full of parodied, subverted mythology. And then, you know, I think the final point I jotted down before, the way in which myth is open to many interpretations. The Greeks themselves just endlessly argue about what their own myths mean.
The myths and legends, they are not held in common anymore. In other words, the situation among the Greeks where you could debate the myths, or they were sort of held in common within that particular culture, is no longer the case. Even the most predominant stories of our culture are no longer held predominantly in the minds of many readers and many hearers. So that brings up an interesting sort of problem for the contemporary poet, in that if you are revising a myth that you feel has had this historical and cultural power over a period of time, and you are revising it, you almost have to bring it back from the dead in the mind of the reader to drive the stake through its heart. Interesting ways this plays out with contemporary poets is there is often a recreating of the myth. In other words, this way of translating Greeks or translating the classics of the canon, whatever those classics are, in radical ways that completely alter, in a sense, the original. So you almost have to say, is this a translation or just sort of a springboard into some other creation? But I think one of the real issues is this, what do we hold in common in terms of myth and legend?
It was a fascinating discussion, and unfortunately we can't include the entirety here, although we did get the opportunity to hear Stephen Halliwell recite Homer in ancient Greek. But continuing on the myth and legend theme, Tom Powell here reads from a poem which he picked especially for this theme.
Okay, this is a poem called Shaman, and I wrote it after being in Cuba and meeting the Cuban poet Pablo Armando Fernandez, and it's about legend and myth. This festival, one of its themes, and I think there's something of that in this poem. Because he believes the ribcage offers only temporary shelter for the soul, when he holds his hand to a breastbone, metaphors fly from the spot. An angel rises from one, great wings thrashing the air, its host beneath it like an open grave. From another, an eagle rises into the air, and he shields his eyes from its magnificence and its claws. The mouth of an orchid grows from another, red as the blood which is its bond. Into it a hummingbird smaller than a finger dips its beak. Always, he says, when his fist touches the breastbone, he never has to strike. Something is released, and even the smallest birds with their bright eyes, their articulate wings, are of interest. Because we are on his veranda in late afternoon, the mango's elegant leaves casting us in early shadow, and because I am full of his imagination, I see birds with scarlet throats, with wings of the most intricate tapestry. But as his soft blue eyes on mine all the while, he gently touches my breast, I too feel a stirring within me, some knuckle unclench and wish to be known, a curlew perhaps, a blackbird, or our combative garden robin.
And as he knows that inside each breast lies a bird waiting to reveal its form, though you may prefer to see a flower, a fish, or indeed that angel, so he also knows that which is most frequently overlooked. No matter the cold night it must pass through, no matter the silence in the garden, it remains natural as breath for certain very special birds still to sing.
Today we had another Younger Poets Showcase event, and this one was based around the Clyde Built Poetry Mentorship Scheme, which was partly founded by Jim Carruth. So firstly, I asked Jim something about the motivations behind Clyde Built.
Clyde Built is an apprenticeship scheme set up in Glasgow to support developing poets at the stage where they're still working towards the first full collection or the first pamphlet, and we found that there was a need identified within the city to provide that support, and we thought the best way of providing that support for those poets was to pair three or four younger poets or three or four less experienced poets with an older mentor who'd been through the ropes, who'd brought out collections, and for them to work together over a period of 12 months, both in group sessions and in sort of one-to-ones with them. And we're now approaching our fourth programme, and it's been a wonderful success.
So today we heard from Christy Williamson, Chloe Morris, Susan Rosser and Gordon McInnes. So they were the is it right to say they were the first batch?
Yeah, they were the first batch. I mean, it is still a competition, so people apply, and when they apply, we ask them what their basically what their objectives are and their vision is for their own poetry, and they have to supply a set of five poems, and the judging is all based on the quality of those five poems, and it's a small judging panel, including the mentor that they'll eventually work with. Those four were the first participants, and they've done really well. I think that, as you can see today, they've obviously gelled. There's a lot of support for each other's poetry, and I've seen them and I've seen the applications of them, and I can see the quality of work and how they've developed there, and their relationships and their, in terms of their both their group work and their support with the individual mentor continues.
Does it happen once a year? So is it now Clyde Built 5? Is that
no, Clyde Built, we'll start to recruit for Clyde Built 4 starting in May. So we ask for applications, and the judging takes up to the sort of early summer, and they start in the autumn with the fourth programme. And so what we do is we'll showcase the second programme, which is just finishing in May. And we'll showcase the third programme a year in May. So we're looking forward to it. And it's always very nervous because we're not closely involved with the work that they do in the 12 months, just to see how they've progressed. And it was wonderful today to see they've all developed their own specific voice, and it's all about developing voices. And I can see that they're very different voices, and the confidence coming through to tackle some, you know, poetic forms and challenging subjects, I thought was great.
So now we get to hear from the poets themselves. First up will be Christy Williamson, then followed by Chloe Morris, then Gordon McInnes, and finally Susan Rosser. So, firstly, it's over to Christy.
So this is in Shetland, which these co-mentees of mine faithfully read and commented on, so this is lovely drab. Dew is a wheel-bred bottle of Chateau Latour 1964. Even though it is our young to came with it tastes like, and I'm our poor to pay the sommelier. Dew is a droplet of vodka stuck to the bottom of an ice cube, even though it is as warm as a cot of Russian sable, and my bonds are as cold as a dry north wind. Dew is purest, sweetest water, half again in clown leash, arousing me, mellowing me, bringing the best in me to life. And I am a glass of finest crystal, clinging on to every drop. And this is a poem called Muse. Your body is made of pure poetry. Words and images stick to my fingers when I run them through your hair, rub off onto pages we turn together. Your body is made of pure poetry. simile and metaphor soak into my lips from your mouth, linger when we kiss, waiting to float into the air. Your body is made of pure poetry. In it, I find everything I need. Power, passion, drama, love, life and death are cradled there.
Quite a lot of rain once, actually. But then I live in Glasgow. Rain on rain on rain. The window is a drum skin. We dream of monsoon. Buds turning to stoner stuff. Not get stung. Sorry. I think this is a love poem. Sweetheart Abby, any place you feel your spirit calmed, my love, is our garden. When we die, I'm going to have your heart embalmed, my love, and slipped into my hands to lie with me under the garden. Oh look, here's another one about rain. This one's in the anthology that the MLIT class did the year that I was in St Andrews, Stolen Weather, and it's a little sonnet. It's raining like the world is out of tune, and the only way to turn the dial is down. Down, a young boy looking at his feet. Down, the arrows on a wall of prison shirts. It's pushing down, packing, patting us down, as if we were clay to be pressed back into the earth, the rain tapping us on our skulls, saying, get down, bow down, kneel down, lie down. And we will. Or can we shrug off the weight, shake the tiny hammers from our hairs and shoulders, slip through the gaps in the pattern of light, grow against the flow, green shoots through the frost? On your grave, there are always one or two daisies. If you run fast enough, you won't get wet.
This next poem is on the Stanza website, and it's a Teesside poem. It's called Slem. Slem is a word, the Tees used to be a tidal river until relatively recently, and it means mud flat, if you see a river, the kind of mud at low tide. Slem was also a word in the heavy industry, and if you were slem, you were unreliable, and that meant in heavy industry, you were potentially dangerous to work with. It's also loosely based on seeing some cats being thrown off Victoria Bridge. You know the place. Slim. Definition, mudflat, unreliable, untrustworthy. A man, furtive on the track. A bag flung out from the bank. Slack mire. Boat sputter. Too bare to be called fen. Testing depth. Step by step, merging into parts, sucking, oozing, dense, wader, sediment, legs smothered under a water-puckered press, sluiced into the lashed mud flat, made, unmade, brackish, broken, tracked, a swithering of elements, bare and river-fed. Slim. And looking in the bag, one kitten still alive, five dead. If you ever go to the Jorvik Viking Museum, you will see various dead Vikings and Romans who've died in usually a fairly brutal and violent fashion. And so my response to this, and my son loved it. This is called Skull of a Viking Jorvik. Viking male. Estimated age, late 20s, early 30s, killed by a blow to the head. A piece of clear perspex illustrates the fracture of his frontal eminence, the cleaving completely across the top of his skull of a sharp-edged weapon, most probably a heavy axe. It is thought that whilst poor, he wore some protection for his head. His killer was right-handed. looking from an anterior viewpoint as he sits in this glass case, I commit to memory his fate and place, cause of death, and in the darkness of one life's orbit, come to see my own blue eyes reflecting.
My sister was looking at the blood tests you have when you're pregnant, etc. And because of my science background, she's asked me to look up some information on the internet. And as you know, when you start looking up things on the internet, you get more and more and more bizarre. So you get more and more unusual, freaky diseases. Until I came across some amazing images of fetuses which had basically been calcified. So these fetuses had sort of died in the womb, and the mother, instead of rejecting them, had actually sort of, it was calcium from the bones to actually calcify these things in her body, so you get these stone babies as lithopedians. And so this is a bit of gory poem about this freaky phenomenon. It's called Stone Baby. Your mother didn't want you to grow up, didn't want the world to hurt, avoided the painful separation of birth, kept you nestled in the coils of a warm, fat abdomen, made you a shell from her bones, her precious red pearl, calmer of skull and spine, safe in your ammonite sleep, until you were alone, cooling in a bed of her ashes. I went on a visit to Vietnam, and we went to Hanoi and visited the Hanoi Women's Museum, which was absolutely fascinating. It had all manner of weird things, and like poor women who had lost 7 sons to the fighting, and they had like little pots and stuff from their houses which memorialised the suffering of women and the prices that women have paid in the Vietnam War. And there was one particular exhibit which really sort of struck me and made me think the Americans had no chance. And on this exhibit was the words hair tripwire or washing line. That was the label on it. And a small coil of plaited black hair. So this is called Hair Tripwire or Washing Line, Hanoi Women's Museum. Was it brushed 100 times before bed and then again in the morning? Mother singing softly, telling you to be still. Did you cry when it was cut by Mr. Trang, whilst your grandmother ate sticky rice and gossiped with his wife? Did your sisters fight over ribbons, learning how to plait? Your friends swap scented oils and stories about boys? When there were no more ribbons, the boys all gone to fight, did you pluck it out, strand by strand? Thank you very much.
For more information on each of those poets, go to the stanzapoetry.org website. And from new poets to older poets, or past poets in fact, with an event celebrating the poetry and the life of eccentric Ivor Cutler. And it was a privilege to have Tony Ward, his publisher and friend, to talk about Ivor. So, it's over to Tony.
He came from Glasgow, as you know, and he had a difficult childhood. And he lived the life, the only life, I think, that he actually knew. When he wrote stuff, some of it was just totally autobiographical. He didn't know any different. And I'm convinced of that. And he would... I don't know whether... his father was a rather peculiar immigrant, Jewish immigrant, and they ended in Glasgow believing they were in America. And as a consequence, he was a bit, I think he was a bit befuddled, his father, but to go fishing or to do anything normal with a child was not in his vocabulary. He didn't know how to deal with children. And the Scottish sitting room is a classic example. There, half of that stuff's autobiographical, you know. And when he sort of goes to the Sahara and his dad gives him a plate of sand, that is the Sahara. And that's it. That's what Ivor was brought up with. And also, of course, Ivor was viciously jealous of his baby sister, and he tried to kill her with a poker. He just got caught in time. Don't kill her, Ivor. You know. Peculiar. It was very peculiar. So he grew up in this manner of eccentricity. So I do believe that a lot of the stuff we read in his work is based in autobiography or just the manner in which he found it, the only way he could live. Can you imagine? He was trained in the RAF as a navigator. Can you imagine being navigated by an iPhone in an aeroplane? And I asked him about this. I said, did you ever fly? He said, I did once. I said, well, where did you end up? He said, well, I don't know. The pilot had to bring us back. He said, I don't know where I was, really. So they took him off. It was too much. And of course, then he went into teaching, and very unconventional, his drama teaching. And it was really thought that half the time that he got more out of it than the students. He had two children, and you know, he, in a way, he treated his children like his father had treated him. So they went fishing with a. He said, "Let's go fishing, Jeremy. Let's go, you know." So he attached to a piece of string a fork and went down and started fishing in a paddle. And Jeremy was a bit upset by this. He said, "Dad, it's not fishing." I said, "Well, it's near enough. Yeah. Just because there's no fish doesn't mean to say we're not fishing." You know, so it was a very difficult and unconventional childhood, so to speak. Both for everybody, really. I mean, he was, I think, a very difficult man to live with, impossible to live with. His relationship with Phyllis April King was on and off for 40 years. And I knew when it was off because he'd phone us so many times in a week. When it was on, he'd phone us only once or twice a week. And he'd be on the phone for hours, what should I do? You know, is it all right to do this, that and the other? He was a very insecure man. But if he hadn't been insecure, he wouldn't have been able to do what he did. I'm sure he wouldn't have been able to go onto a stage and swing a whole audience of 16 to 80 year olds just like that. He didn't have to say anything, he just came onto the stage. I don't know whether how many of you saw him, but I think most people have seen him actually. And he used to go onto a stage and just swing an audience without even saying anything. All he had to do was trundle the harmonium on for a start, and that would get people collapsing with laughter. And I could never actually understand why people would laugh at it. He said, there's nothing funny about that. The fact that he was dressed in umpteen layers and two hats had nothing to do with it, of course. But anyway, that was it. He was a good publicist too. He used to send his books all over the place. I found a letter here that he'd sent one to Honey magazine. what's that got to do with our cover, Honey magazine? I never really asked. I don't remember asking him what on earth Honey magazine had to do it, but he sent them everywhere that he thought somebody would say something about them, good, bad, and different. And it worked. And it was terrific as far as we were concerned. But his legacy lives on, of course, with the I don't know whether you read about the dance that has just come out from Ashley Page. He's using Cockle-Doodle-Don't as the basis of this dance, and it's gone worldwide. It's amazing.
And if you still happen to be in St Andrews, a Stuggy Prynne, Ivor Cutler, is still on show at the Public Library Meeting Room. We end today's podcast with another poet from Brian Johnson's Director's Cut, and this time it's the superb John Glenday.
Well, I suppose I'll start with this one, which is a sort of a love poem, and I always call my poems sort of love poems, because they're very elliptical sometimes. But it just hinges on what I think is one of these lovely little-known facts of life, which was that the can opener was invented 48 years after the tin can. And I think, you know, what a strange idea. Now, what do people do for 48 years with their tins of food? But, of course, the original tin cans were made of such heavy gauge metal that you needed, you know, a grenade or a hammer and chisel to get into them. So this poem's called Tin. When you asked me for a love poem, another love poem, my thoughts were immediately drawn to the early days of the food canning industry. All those strangely familiar trade names from childhood, Del Monte, Green Giant, Fray Bentos, Heinz. I thought of Franklin and his poisoned men drifting quietly northwest by north towards the scooped shale of their graves. And I thought of the first tin of cling peaches glowing on a dusty pantry shelf like yet-to-be-discovered radium. the very first tin of cling peaches in the world, and for half a century, my fingers reaching out for it. Another love poem, strangely enough, and this one for the all those horrible deep sea fishes, the ones that, you know, they've got jaws like gin traps, and most of them have some sort of phosphorescent element to them, so they generate their own light, if you like, and some of them it's actually bacteria that do that. The angler fish that have little fishing rods on their foreheads. It's called the ugly. And it starts off really just with a list of these strange fishes. I love you as I love the hatchet fish, the allmouth, the angler, the sawbelly and wolf eel, the stoplight loose jaw, the fang tooth, all our sweet bathypelagic ones, and especially those too terrible or sly, even for Latin names, who staple their menfolk to the vagina's hide like scorched purses, stiff with seed, whom God built to trawl endless cathedrals of darkness, their bland eyes gaping like sores, who would choke down hunger itself had it pith and gristle enough, who carry on their foreheads the trembling light of the world. And the last one, which, dead simple idea really, it was Beauty and the Beast, Disney's Beauty and the Beast, backwards, and the reason I turned it backwards because I thought that real life is really the fairy tale in reverse, because in the real world we start off from a reasonably bright and sunny and happy ever after beginning, if you like, and then things get more difficult for us by and large, and doors are closed and shutters come in, and we end up almost at the beginning of the fairy tale. Women tend to kiss princes and they turn into frogs more than the other way around in the real world. A fairy tale. She had been living happily ever before, waltzing through imagined ballrooms in the arms of a handsome young prince. Then, one day, they kiss for the first time. He takes back the word love, and suddenly bloats to an idle, wounded beast that stoops above her in its thickening hide. She trembles before his laboured breath and white strange eyes. Each night from her solitary bed she overhears the echoes of unimaginable rages which transform their castle to a ruin of shadowy rooms with a cursed and sleeping heart. At last she understands him poorly enough to be terrified and run a gauntlet of scattering wolves to the arms of her sick father, who greets her with a tearful goodbye. They subsist forever after on a diet of simple gruel and vague desire. When passers-by ask her about her life, she waltzes the laundry to her heart and answers with a distant smile, "Once upon a time."
Well, that's the end of another Stanza Festival Poetry Podcast. We hope that you enjoyed it. We'll be back tomorrow for our final day, Sunday. Hope to see you then.